Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. This is our second episode about Canada and the Declaration of Independence with author and historian Mark R. Anderson. Throughout both of these episodes, we have been trying to answer the question, why did Canada, the 14th North American colony, refuse to join the other 13 North American colonies in their war of independence against British rule? Well, the first episode gave us at least two partial answers. First, Canada, also known as the Province of Quebec, was quite different from the other colonies. Most importantly, Canada had been a French colony for many years before it was ceded to Britain at the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763. During its long history as a French colony, it had developed its own Quebecois laws and customs that were quite different from the British laws and customs in the other colonies. Of course, Quebec was also a Catholic colony, so even though some British Protestants emigrated to Canada between 1763 and 1776, they were a tiny minority. So in 1775, when the Revolutionary War began, Canada was still overwhelmingly Catholic and Quebecois. The second reason Canada refused to join the revolution was the Quebec Act of 1774, which is referenced in the American Declaration of Independence as evidence of King George's oppression. But if you were to have asked a French Canadian about the act, he might have actually liked it. How to explain this? Well, we need to take a step back to the end of the Seven Years' War, when Quebec had been turned over to Britain. You can imagine that the new British rulers of French Canada had to tread a fine line between asserting Canada's new Britishness, on the one hand, and respecting the Quebecois majority, on the other. If the new British rulers alienated French Canadians too much, they risked the possibility of a Quebecois revolution. Enter Guy Carleton, the British governor of Quebec, who hatched a plan to keep French Canadians happy with their new British rulers. He listened to their concerns, learned about their problems, and then negotiated the Quebec Act, which affirmed and protected Quebecois religious, civil, and legal customs, thereby keeping them loyal to King George. I think it's important to stress this point. Although you might assume that French Canadians would have supported independence against their new, strange, and Protestant British king, with whom they had been at war for literally decades, this was not the case. And the Quebec Act, which affirmed their identity as Quebecois, was a key reason why French Canadians did not rebel. But let's return now to Philadelphia, the seat of the Continental Congress. We find ourselves in the spring of 1775. Congress has already sent two letters to the oppressed people of Canada, arguing that they should join the struggle for independence, arguing that they are indeed oppressed. However, neither letter has tipped the scales in Canada in favor of rebellion. On May the 1st, 1775, the Quebec Act officially comes into effect in Canada. 6 weeks later, on the 14th of June, 1775, the Continental Congress authorizes the creation of the First Continental Army. And now, Congress is deliberating its first directive for their newly formed army. The invasion of Canada, or should I say, the liberation of Canada. All right, back to the show. Okay, so we have this second letter from Congress to the oppressed inhabitants of Canada who still aren't entirely sure if they're oppressed or not. But again, if the goal of that letter was to achieve some general uprising of Canadians, or the majority of Canadians, against British rule and the Quebec Act in favor of some alliance with the colonies, that didn't happen. So this, plus all of the other turbulence in that summer, eventually now lead Congress to the Continental Congress in the United States or in Philadelphia to choose or opt for invasion. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that thought process?
So as we talked about, the second letter reassured the Canadians that Congress would only be acting in their interests and they had no intents to come up and oppress them. But this rapidly developing situation sees some encouragement for intervention. The second letter really doesn't spark this, but the communications going on back and forth between like-minded people in Canada and leaders in the colonies starts to see the common ground, the potential that an intervention may help be the key that brings the Canadians in, provide that last link to the continent-wide union or confederation, more technically speaking, to achieve their political goals. But also, Governor Carleton has not only established martial law, but is communicating with Indian nations in Canada to try to get them to help defend the province. And given the long tradition of war between the traditional 13 colonies and New France and their Indian allies for generations, this fits into the declaration's mention of fit instruments for introducing absolute rule. They see that Governor Carleton may be organizing his forces to come in and invade and help oppress the colonies, and the intelligence just is not very good. They know that the British regular force in Canada is extremely weak. They're getting strong indicators that the French Canadians don't really have an interest in taking up arms against the other colonies. But the big variable is the Indian communities that are in Canada that have traditionally been the ones that raided the New England and New York frontiers that would introduce a second front in what's now growing to be a revolutionary war. They get all this conflicting intelligence about what the Indian communities in Canada are going to do. And there's a threat that the British government might also build ships in Canada that would help contest the Americans' control of Lake Champlain and that highway of warfare. So with information coming from the committees in Canada, these intelligence reports, and the traditional worries, Continental Congress on June 27th, shortly within 2 weeks after creating the Continental Army, gives the Northern Department Commander, General Philip Schuyler, the authority to destroy or take any British ships on Lake Champlain, and a much more loose authority that, if practicable and not disagreeable to the Canadians, he was authorized to take possession of St. John's, that's the fort right on the border, Montreal, and any other parts of the country that he felt were necessary to promote, quote, peace and security. General Schuyler just didn't have a force ready when he received these orders, so he spends weeks gathering troops that are being sent up, most importantly, gathering supplies, and trying to get confidence that there really is a desire in Canada for an intervention. And of course, he's in communication with the people that are most aligned with the Patriots. So he gets messages that, yes, maybe an invasion might be helpful. And even some of the Indian communities there send messengers that indicate that they might support an intervention. And that's a totally different topic. But there is, at least in the information that General Schuyler is getting, an indication that there would be support if there was an armed intervention. The real trigger of the invasion is when there are intelligence reports that a ship is about to be completed at Fort St. John's, which would create a new military problem. So this prompts the actual invasion that starts at the end of August. The first invaders arrive in Canada on the 5th of September, and General Schuyler immediately writes a manifesto, a message to the Canadians explaining why this invasion is happening. He declares that he's come to restore Canadians' British rights, regardless of class or religion, by expelling the ministerial troops who serve as tools of oppression. And he promised to protect Canadians and their property. He has this translated to French and distributed to known people, particularly in the Richelieu Valley, who have been communicating with him, who then distribute it, and it gets out throughout the province pretty quickly. So General Schuyler is leading this invasion into the Richelieu Valley down by Montreal. General Washington in Boston has an idea for another invasion path into Canada, and he sends Benedict Arnold to lead a force through the Maine wilderness to fall across the Appalachian and go into the Chaudière River Valley, which leads up to Quebec City, and hopefully surprise Quebec City and take that. George Washington provides Arnold with instructions and his own message, very similar to what Schuyler is communicating, that they're invading Quebec, quote, by the advice of many friends of liberty. And they're sending troops not to plunder, but to protect you, to animate and bring forth into action those sentiments of freedom, which the tools of despotism would extinguish. And making similar declarations on the invaders' obligation to protect property and religion. The invasion has a tremendous impact on allegiances in Canada, where we had previously had the British Party and the French Party. There's a complete redrawing of partisan lines. It becomes loyalist and patriot rebel parties that quickly form in response to the invasion. Some of the old subject English merchants and many of the rural habitant Canadian farmers rally to support the invasion. There are hundreds of Canadians that take up arms and fight alongside the American troops trying to take Fort St. John's from the British regulars and the subsequent things that happen. But the invasion finally pushes many of the British Party Canadians who had opposed the Quebec Act to tie themselves to loyalty to the king and parliament. This finally prompts the recalcitrant or reluctant old subjects to form a real urban militia in the cities, and followed by their example by some of the French population in the cities as well. So it finally serves as a means to rally people who will fight for the king in Canada as well.
Can I just break in here and ask you to describe who was the Canadian rebel like? So by rebel, I mean the one who was supporting the American invasion. What type of person is this?
So there's, on the old subject, Anglo-Protestant side, we have merchants. Thomas Walker, who had been an opponent to the British vision of Canadian rule since the time he arrived in the province shortly after the conquest, he's the most outspoken. He's zealous. He hates the government, essentially. James Price, who I talked about going to Philadelphia, he just sees common interest between the merchants in Canada and what's going on in the 13 colonies. And then we have this individual, James Livingston, who lives in the Richelieu River Valley. He's a grain merchant. He's tied to the Livingston family, kin to the Livingston family in New York. So he sees these common interests as well, and he uses his influence amongst the farmers to persuade them that they have a lot to gain by tying themselves to the American cause.
They and these are French-Canadian farmers.
French-Canadian, yes, that is correct. They can get themselves free from the landholders, perhaps truly own their own land, and not have a legal obligation, perhaps, to pay the tithes to their parish priests, have it a free will offering rather than an obligatory extraction from their produce. So in the months before the invasion, there started to be cells formed that would spread the messages. And once the invasion happened, it took a few days and an expression of intent by the invaders to actually follow through now that they had come to Canada. But then they start to arrive and join the army and actually operate behind lines and affect British communication between Montreal and Fort St. John's as well.
And their primary targets would be British regular troops. They weren't going after so-called fellow Canadians at this point.
Initially, that is true. But as the fighting grows, the first key battles around Fort St. John's actually end up with loyalist Canadians on one side fighting patriot rebel Canadians on the other side. So it doesn't take very long for Canadians to be fighting Canadians.
All right. Very interesting. So the invasion starts and there is some initial success, but then it quickly turns. Why don't you just describe the flow of the invasion before we get to the final letter from Congress to the inhabitants of Canada?
So keeping the military campaign very short, so there's the initial invasion, fighting around Fort St. John's with General Schuyler's branch of the invasion. General Schuyler gets sick almost immediately, and shortly after writing his manifesto, he goes back to Fort Ticonderoga to recover and make sure that supplies and troops keep coming north. So the invasion falls to General Richard Montgomery, who lays a siege around Fort St. John's, that border fort, And the British and Loyalists hold out there for about 45 days, a long delay in the invasion. But once they finally force, the Americans finally force the fort to surrender, they essentially have the rest of the province. The wall has been broken, and Montgomery leads his army to take Montreal without a fight. Governor Guy Carleton leads his Loyalists out of Montreal to flee to Quebec City, where they'll hole up. Benedict Arnold, meanwhile, has been trying to make his invasion. It takes him much longer to get over the wilderness path to arrive at Quebec City, and he fails to surprise Quebec City and ends up having to establish a camp a distance away and wait for Montgomery to come and join him. So Quebec City becomes the last bastion of British rule. The rest of the province is essentially left to the Americans by the time we get to December 1775. Early on, Schuyler and Montgomery are already asking Congress for political help. They're willing to lead the military campaign, but they just don't have the bandwidth to worry about how to rally Canadian political support and start to form a patriot political organization in Canada. They don't get that for a long time, and that will come up hopefully later in our discussion. So there's a stalemate by the time we get to December 1775. Governor Carleton, a few regulars, but mostly militia, are holed up in Quebec City, and they're going to try to wait until the spring of 1776 because the St. Lawrence River freezes from November to the end of April. So they're going to have to hold out that amount of time, but then they expect the British are going to come and save them. There's no reason why the same empire that conquered Canada 15 years before aren't going to come and do it again. General Montgomery, because his troops enlistments are about to expire and because he's being told by like-minded Canadians, patriot Canadians, that he needs to conquer Quebec City before he will really be able to rally the Canadians behind him, he decides on New Year's Eve, 1775, to attack Quebec City, and it's a debacle. He's killed, Benedict Arnold is wounded, and British Loyalist Canadians hold Quebec City, and now there's just a blockade maintained outside Quebec City. And the weak Americans just aren't getting troops, they aren't getting resources, they're imposing on the French Canadians, and there starts to be widespread disenchantment with the American occupation after this. When the British fleet arrives, as Governor Carleton expected, on May 6, 1776, the American invasion just collapses. There's a massive retreat, there's embarrassing defeats as the army flows back out. But going back to the third letter from Congress, after Montgomery's defeat, Congress decides to send one more letter to Canada. January 24, 1776, they again send this letter that says, "We will never abandon you to the unrelenting fury of your and our enemies," and goes back to the political of, "We advise and exhort you to establish associations in your different parishes of the same nature with those which have proved so salutary to the United Colonies." Remembering, they're still the United Colonies at this time. This is before the Declaration of Independence. "To elect deputies to form a provincial assembly, and that said assembly be instructed to appoint delegates to represent them in this Congress." This, again, is essentially another dead letter. It doesn't get great distribution. It doesn't have any resonance. As I talked about in one of Montgomery's reasons for trying to attack Quebec City, the province, even though it's under American occupation, just isn't going to rally behind the American cause until British presence is eliminated altogether.
This is a group of people who have just, within very recent memory, swapped imperial rulers. You can sort of understand their hesitation. You know, whatever decisions happen to be made in London or Philadelphia or Paris, France, well, you know, can we just live our lives and we'll side with whoever comes out on top or with whomever the clergy tell us to support, you know?
Yes. Just like the revolution, as John Adams describes in the 13 colonies, you've got one element of maybe a third that choose the king's side, a third that choose the rebel side, and the big third in the middle that really just wants to go about living their lives and adapts to circumstances. And that's true in Canada as well as in the other colonies, the numbers varying slightly, but there's clearly this huge group in the middle that doesn't particularly care about choosing sides.
The other note I wanted to make about the third letter is it's reverted back to the title of the first letter. So And again, is a letter to the inhabitants of Quebec, no longer the letter to the oppressed inhabitants of Quebec.
Yes, because they've been liberated.
So it's always funny to see how these words change. Okay, so as of May, the American Colonial Army is beating its way back south of the border. And now we're rapidly getting towards the Declaration of Independence. So how do we tell that story, Mark?
So there's one other important development in early 1776 that's important to consider. And that is, I mentioned earlier that General Schuyler, General Montgomery had asked for political support from the Continental Congress. That takes an achingly long time to come to fruition. It's after Montgomery's failed attack that Congress finally starts acting on it. It takes them a long time to figure out who's going to be the representatives of a committee to Canada and what their authorities and message is going to be. Eventually, they choose Benjamin Franklin and Samuel Chase of Maryland as the representatives who are delegates in the Continental Congress to go north into Canada and provide political leadership. And there's a third player, Charles Carroll of Carrollton, a Catholic Marylander, who's not yet a delegate to the Continental Congress, but they choose him as a representative, and they bring along two other adjuncts to this committee. Charles Carroll's cousin, the Jesuit father John Carroll, to show that the Americans have some incorporation of Catholics, and a French-born Philadelphia printer, Fleury Mesplet, who's going to join them along with his printing press to provide a free press in Canada. Because of delays in getting these authorities and messages, they don't leave Philadelphia until March 26th. So this is 6 months or more after the invasion started and the first request for this kind of support. And they don't arrive in Montreal because of weather and other responsibilities they had on their way until April 29th. So they get there a week before the British arrive. It's way too late to have any influence. But I like to think that, as I saw in a previous interview about religion, it's showing this willingness of the Americans to embrace Catholicism, and that Charles Carroll and John Carroll are both chosen as representatives, formal or informal, of this committee.
Yeah, and maybe we're seeing the first baby steps towards the subsequent separation of church and state clauses in the colony of Virginia or the Commonwealth of Virginia, and then in the United States Constitution too. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. So wrapping up the invasion, Benedict Arnold is the last American to push off from the mainland of Canada on June 18th. So we're getting very close to the Declaration of Independence, and the last troops reach Crown Point on July 1st. The invasion is done. A complete disaster. It's no surprise that Canada, never represented in the Continental Congress, is omitted from the document, other than this Grievance 20 reference to the Quebec Act. But the Declaration of Independence was written concurrent with congressional investigation into the failure in Canada. Thomas Jefferson being a key member of both these committees, and you look into Thomas Jefferson's notes from the time, and you see that there's some feedback, or at least concurrent thought, going on between his two different responsibilities. So that's a subtle influence on the Declaration of Independence, particularly when it comes to his reference to the savage, merciless Indians. But John Adams provides a different view on the Declaration and Canada. Writing on July 3rd, in the time between when Congress had agreed to independence but before the Declaration had been approved, he wrote that had a Declaration of Independence been made 7 months ago, it would have been attended with many great and glorious effects. We should have mastered Quebec and been in possession of Canada. In this letter, he writes that half-hearted commitment in Congress had caused obstructions and embarrassments and studied delays, which have finally lost us the province. He believed that there were too many elements in Congress that were not fully committed and still hoped for reconciliation, and that was why Congress had dilly-dallied so much in sending troops, supplies, and a political committee to Canada.
And a dilly-dallying Congress. It's good to know that the American traditions held firm all the way back to July 3rd, 1776.
Yes.
Okay.
Canadian responses to Declaration of Independence, as you kind of alluded to in your introduction, is a remarkable silence. This is in part due to the timing. There's not even a message sending the Declaration of Independence to Canada until August 7th, and that goes through official military channels to be delivered to Governor Carleton, and he's certainly not going to be distributing the Declaration of Independence to the Canadians. Governor Carleton also clearly establishes British rule back in Canada. He's very generous in reestablishing rule. He recognizes that this is a war of hearts and minds. So while he is willing to arrest those patriot rebel Canadians who still linger after the invasion has left, it's on very generous terms. As soon as they prove that they're ready to be responsible subjects again, they're freed, as long as they're willing to practice good behavior. And so there's certainly not going to be any overt communication and discussion of the Declaration of Independence that might reach Governor Carleton's ears, or there will be subject to some sort of punishment. There are, however, Canadians in exile. With the evacuation of the army from Canada, two Canadian Continental regiments had actually been formed during the invasion, and these regiments flee with the rest of the army and remain in the Continental Army when they get back to the 13 colonies. And many of the Patriot Canadian leaders fled in the evacuation as well and accepted different roles in the different colonies and different service at the Continental Congress once they got south and out of Canada.
Did any rebels choose to stay, or was it a complete removal of...
There were a few rebels that chose to stay. And some tried spending a few years under British rule and then fled. And these are small numbers. And then there's the printer that had gone with the committee north, Fleury Masblay. He remains with his printing press that he hoofed all the way or boated all the way into Canada, lays low for a while, and then establishes a new Montreal newspaper, but he's a little bit too enlightenment in his publications. So Governor Haldimand actually imprisons him for a while, Haldimand being the successor to Governor Carleton. But eventually, Masblay is freed as the war comes to a close, and he establishes the Montreal Gazette, which becomes a longstanding Canadian newspaper.
Fascinating. And you just did mention Haldimand, so why don't you talk about how Haldimand approached quashing political dissent, besides imprisoning this poor newspaper
yes.
man?
So where Carleton was willing to pretty much live and let die, Haldimand had a stricter view. If there was any hint detectable of disloyalty, not being a loyalist, there was going to be some punishment for that. It was really a change in spirit in Canada to get them, keep them strong through the rest of the war.
And indeed, through the rest of the war, did the British regiments stay north of the border? Was there ever an incursion?
There were two British invasions from Canada. 1776, in the fall, Governor Carleton leads an invasion that doesn't get any farther than Crown Point at the south end of Lake Champlain before they run out of time, because Benedict Arnold has kept a navy on Lake Champlain that delayed their travel down into the colonies. That invasion returns to come back and reform for a second invasion under General Burgoyne in 1777 that culminates in the battle and surrender at Saratoga. So a key battle there. There's also talk and general planning of a couple other American ideas of invading Canada again, just never have the resources for that. But there's still lingering American hopes that Canada will join the Confederation.
Right. But my question there has to do with, in those British invasion forces from Canada, were they mostly British regular forces or like Hessians, or were there actual like French Canadians or any type of Canadian militia joining in the counter-invasion, we might say?
That is a great point. There are small Canadian contingents. The upper class Canadians that had allied themselves with the British government play an important role as leaders amongst Indian allies to these invasion forces. But very few of the Canadians that are involved are actually going to be fighters. They're going to be more logistic support. Governor Carleton has recognized that there's not any great zeal for invading the southern colonies amongst the Canadians who would serve as troops. So we're talking small numbers of hundreds involved and they're not going to be the key fighters. It's going to be British regulars, Hessians, and Indian allies that do the bulk of the fighting in these invasions.
Okay, so it seems again that the Canadians weren't willing to exact revenge on the colonies by joining the British regulars to attack the colonies. So how do we carry on telling this story, Mark?
So in the Continental Congress, there's still lingering American hopes that Canada will join the Union. The Articles of Confederation, the first constitution accepted by Congress in November 1777, shortly after this victory at Saratoga, includes an article that says Canada, acceding to this confederation and joining in the measures of the United States, shall be admitted into and entitled to all the advantages of this union. It is the only other British colony given this exception. Any other colonies would have to be approved by at least 9 states. So there's this very open door left to Canada, obviously not taken. And then in the Paris peace negotiations, Benjamin Franklin, who, remember, had actually seen American-occupied Montreal firsthand, still floated a hope that Great Britain might give Canada in the peace negotiations as a form of reparations to the United States. Very unlikely, but he still held out hope. And that sort of wraps up Canada and American hopes for Canada as the Revolutionary War concludes and we end up with 2 separate political entities sealed by the peace.
So what was the basis for that lingering hope? It's just going through everything that you've said, it just seems that the Canadians were going to be noncommittal to anyone besides the existing imperial ruler. So why did Franklin or the rest of the newly independent colonies, why are these politicians still thinking that Canada would change its mind?
I guess they had seen enough support in the 1775-1776 invasion to believe that, and had made enough accommodation that they believed realistically Canada could be part. They had proven that they didn't have the military force to do it, but perhaps there was a political way. And if there was a new government was established in Canada under the United States, or as part of the United States, more correctly, in the time of the Confederation, that they would willingly become a part of that new government.
Interesting. And so the Paris peace negotiations happen. Do the Canadians care that this war is over and their southern neighbor is now an independent republic?
There just doesn't seem to be a lot of discussion or concern about how this new relationship is, except I guess there's probably some concerns about the fur trade in that the new border cuts through the area that had been key parts of the fur trade. But in effect, there's no real impact on the Canadians and don't really see any lingering impacts there.
Okay, so America is now independent. It's the big brother to the south with its own history. Then we have Canada to the north of the border. So the next point we maybe need to discuss here is how, despite the fact that Canada remained on the British imperial side, obviously the fact of the revolution and the fact of this huge new country beneath them did in fact have many important impacts on the development of Canada. So why don't you just talk a little bit about that, please?
So as peace is achieved, there's a huge loyalist migration from the 13 states that adds to differences between Canada and the United States and adds a new character to this difference. Loyalists leave the 13 states and go to different parts of Canada. And the Maritime provinces, which had primarily been Nova Scotia during the time of the war, there's a huge settlement and it generates the new province of New Brunswick. And there's another wave of migration that goes past the traditional lands of Quebec to settle further up the St. Lawrence River and in the Great Lakes region by the Loyalist Anglo-Protestant population. And that results in the Canada Act of 1791, creating Upper Canada, which is an Anglo-Protestant, has its own assembly, and Lower Canada, which is what had been the province of Quebec before and after. So there's this very loyalist character that adds on to the traditionally different French-Canadian character. So in a large part, they're defined by not being American. And these differences are reinforced again in the War of 1812.
Right. So I've learned so much, Mark. Thank you so much for everything you said. I'm trying to synthesize everything you said and encapsulate it in one idea, and this is what I've come up with. When we look at the various groups in Canada, you have the French Canadians. You have French Canadian farmers who maybe are just interested in their own farms and don't want to get involved in politics. You have a Catholic clergy with all of its connections and tentacles back to the French king and then back to the Roman Catholic Church. You have this aristocracy of French landowners. You have these new Anglo-Protestants who come in after the end of the French and Indian War with their own traditions. You have the Native American tribes many of whom have allied with the French in Quebec against the British. And yet, as all of these different political events are happening, what you would call traditional allegiances and traditional alliances are just dropped. You would expect maybe that the French Canadians who had just been conquered by the British would support the American rebels, but no, they don't. And you would expect that the Anglo-Protestants who had moved there, the old settlers, before the revolution started, would be supportive of the king. But no, that's not the case. So there's like revolution and counter-revolution happening. And of course, France is the huge part of this story. And the traditional enemy of the colonies is France and the French. And who does Ben Franklin go and get to ally with them in their war against their British king? It's, of course, the King of France. So maybe the lesson in all of this about Canada and Canadian history is that traditional friends and enemies are not more important than immediate self-interest. Tradition doesn't actually matter that much in all of this. Your traditional friend can become a new enemy overnight, and that's just how it is. And lots of people just might not care either way. So that's kind of my takeaway. What is your takeaway thinking about the relationship between Canada and the Declaration of Independence now 250 years later?
In the United States, the political and military campaigns with Canada before the Declaration helped form a more expansive and inclusive definition of who the American people could be, as they came up with ways to incorporate people with a different religion, language, and history. We have Congress sending political messages, military commanders doing the same, Washington forbidding Pope Day celebrations in the Continental Army, and Congress officially including Catholics to the Commission to Canada and employing Catholic chaplains in the Canadian Continental Regiments, things that would have been unthinkable before they embarked on this path to bring Canada into the Confederation and then the Union. So in Canada, we see that the Declaration just didn't have that much impact on its own, but the invasion and experience with the Americans did have some impact. And I find that one recorded reflection by a minor Canadian official, Jean-Baptiste Badeau, kind of capturing their perspectives of the different governments north and south of the border.
In what year was this?
This is in his journal of the invasion. So okay. It's written originally during the war, but I suspect that this clause is actually inserted after the invasion has failed and government has been restored. And Badeau writes, "I admit that if I find virtues in many Republicans, I find greater defects in a republic in general. This excessive love of liberty moves hearts to undertakings more hardy than generous, and nearly always bloody." As he reflects on the king, he says, "In a people subject to a sole master, I only see zeal, love, and faithfulness. And in he, the king, who governs alone, nothing but tenderness and care for his people. Whereas in the American Republic, he sees so many heads governing a people cannot love it equally, and the people cannot know how to love so many masters at one time. It's a very different concept of what a government brings to the people. While most Canadians then and now would probably have little argument with the Declaration's concepts of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, by choice and circumstance, geographic, demographic, economic, political, and military, they ended up working within British rule and then their own adaptive forms of government to advance those goals in their own way. In the Revolutionary era, a critical mass of Canadians simply did not share the Americans' perspective that Britain was seeking an absolute tyranny, especially in light of the Quebec Act. Over the past 250 years, Canadians have chosen their own course, one very similar to their American neighbors, with common foundations in rights-based values. But Canada and the Canadians have historically generated and practiced alternative ways to achieve their own vision of that sort of freedom.
Marcus Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.